This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
It's now my pleasure to introduce Philip Jones. Philip is almost literally Bob's successor as a curator at the South Australian Museum. He's the inheritor of collections that Bob curated and indeed created. Philip is a distinguished author. He was awarded the Prime Minister's Prize for that wonderful book, Ochre and Rust, and has been the National Museum's Director's Fellow for this year. And as Director's Fellow, Philip has largely programmed today's tribute. So it's my very great pleasure to introduce my colleague, Philip Jones.
Peter, thank you very, very much. And thank you, Neil, for throwing a little light on South Australia at the very end of your presentation, which was extremely generous, I think, to Australian cultural institutions as well as to Bob. I wanted to begin with this run of footage here in order to make a simple point. It'll come to rest in a minute, so I won't go on and on. My simple point really is that Bob, through his experience in South Australia, and particularly at the South Australian Museum, but particularly working with Aboriginal people in the field, had come to a basic realisation that culture, human culture, not just Aboriginal culture or Australian culture, could be rendered tangible. And having rendered it tangible in some way, either through the distillation of collections in museums or even through publications and films, it would be possible and it should be the obligation to bring this material before the public. And I consider that this is something that Bob learnt very early, probably in the South Australian Museum, if not even earlier, in the fields and orchards of the Marion District in South Australia and the Sturt Creek, where he came across Aboriginal stone tools and noticed and realised what they were before all of that legacy was swept away by development in South Australia. In the mid-70s, Bob's career took off, literally. He, as Neil has said, began visiting the world and bringing the world to Australia. And before that, in the mid-70s, in 1973, he'd left Adelaide and become the deputy principal of the Institute of Aboriginal Studies, as it then was, before moving to the Aboriginal Arts Board as its founding director in 1975. Thereafter, he becomes almost undetectable by the radar. I don't know of a taller poppy in Australian cultural life who's avoided the lawnmower. And he was always a moving target in a way. Not even a target, partly because of his self-effacement, but also partly because of this team approach that Neil has underlined. The idea that you actually did pass the ownership of the ideas that you developed to the team, to the extent that they lived and breathed without you. I want to make the point that this liftoff, if you like, in the mid-1970s was prefigured by a paradigm shift. And this is a little bit analytical, I know, for today, and it may not be supportable, but I want to make the proposition based on two things. Firstly, in Bob's time in the South Australian Museum, he arrived there in 1965 in his mid-30s, having had a career that we'll hear about from Dick Richards a little later, as a fruiterer and greengrocer, if you like, an orchardist, and a man of the land. And in the museum in South Australia, he found himself rubbing shoulders with other tall poppies in the South Australian cultural sphere. T.D. Campbell, Draper Campbell, as he was known, Charles Mountford, Norman Tyndale was still on the scene. Ted Strelow was in the precinct, if not actually in the museum. These were big names and big egos, if you like. The museum itself was in a parlous condition and remained in that condition for several years. One of the mainstays of the group was a diminutive, another self-effacing individual, Harold Cooper, Mr. Cooper, as Bob refers to him even now. He was an amateur stone tool collector, and through Cooper and Campbell in particular, Bob familiarised himself with a whole suite of Aboriginal stone tool technology and then went out into the field looking for it and documenting it. Through his association with Charles Mountford, he went into the field also looking for and documenting rock art, and particularly in the first instance concentrating on rock engravings. Mountford had done pioneering work in northern South Australia, and Bob extended the reach of these expeditions into Central Australia and Northern Australia. And during this period, he developed, I think, what he probably saw as his the scope of his ambition, which was to really attempt to map the distribution and the antiquity of rock engravings in Australia. This gave him the tools, the wherewithal to do the sort of field work that brought him into contact, particularly with Aboriginal people, in a series of field trips through the late 1960s. And the footage that was up here earlier is from Arnhem Land in the late 60s. And I believe it was through this field work and the exposure to the traditional owners of country that he was working in that Bob reached a realisation relating to what could be done with cultural material, particularly in Australia. He began with site recording and working with a group of traditional owners who had rights in particular areas such as Mount Singleton and the Clearland Hills, the Yuendumu district, so Walpree and Pintupi people and later Pitjantjatjara people when he went further south to the Officer Creek region near Ernabella. And it was at that latter area in July of 1969 that Bob found himself drawn into closer relationships with these people. He was recording a little bit of mythology. He was being invited to ceremony, going through the night, and then working with those same people, documenting rock art during the day. And on one particular occasion, he had brought some film with him of some footage that had been taken in Western Australia in the goldfields and some tapes that had been made there of ceremony recorded with Aboriginal people. And he had the opportunity to play these tapes to the old men who were there on the Officer Creek in May 69. And they immediately recognised the songs and began singing with them and told him that they knew the lines of story that came through Uldia up to Indalkina into this country. And Bob was able to tell them that this particular site where the recording had been made was under threat through the mining of stone for Perth homes. Nice variegated colours in the stone. And the people immediately realised that he was somebody who could actually make representations on their behalf to government, and asked Bob to write a letter to the government to prevent this desecration of an important site. And I believe it was from this point that Bob realised that the only way to record and document Aboriginal sites properly and to extend this approach to heritage management as a whole was in a total partnership, honest and complete, with the Aboriginal owners of the sites and the material. And it was this paradigm shift, I think, that distinguished him from possibly the Draper Campbells and the Charles Mountfords and the Harold Coopers, who had essentially adopted a traditional museological approach to culture, that is, an expert-driven approach, scooping up the material, bringing it in and processing it. I think Bob realised from this point on that, no, there had to be a further element. And it was this, I think, in the UNESCO seminar or conference that he organised in Adelaide in 1971, which brought people together from all over the country concerned with the preservation of Aboriginal art, that equipped him for making the next shift in his career. In the meantime, of course, he'd also been looking more closely at the museum that he was a part of and had inherited the collection, which was in a remarkable collection. It still is, I think, the finest Aboriginal collection in the world. But the Norman Tyndale years, which had brought a lot of it into the museum, had been very focused simply on collecting and not on actually doing a great deal with it in the museum context. And the museum itself was the sort of place where you were advised, if you wanted to visit it, to bring a torch in the mid-1960s. It was really in a bad way. So I think Bob's approach to heritage became applied to the museum itself, in a way, and he knew that this place had to be saved. And before long, you had the sort of networking skills that Neil has been talking about, applied to the dilemma of the South Australian Museum itself. And he did this in a number of subtle ways, and I won't go into the details, we'll maybe cover some of that a little later. But one of them, I think, was introducing the notion to the people of Adelaide more generally that they were living in a cultural landscape, an Aboriginal cultural landscape. The Jilbrooke legend or mythology of the Fleurieu Peninsula, on which Adelaide is sited, was something that few people had even heard of in the mid-1970s. But Bob brought it to the attention of a key journalist in Adelaide who basically turned it into a public campaign for a walking trail or a trail of sites and localities to be marked along the Adelaide coastline. And this, I think, began to introduce the idea to the fringes of settled Australia that there was not necessarily an inner continent and an outer continent in terms of Aboriginal contact, that there was a continuity and an interpenetration of realms, and that it was part of the heritage of the people living in the cities, not only their European heritage, but their Aboriginal heritage as well. This, along with various projects like preserving the canoe trees along the River Murray, and Bob made a film of that, further work on the engravings and paintings in the Adelaide area as well as further north, all swung attention onto this subject to the degree that finally, after the UNESCO conference and Bob's own extraordinary fellowship, which took him to rock art sites throughout Europe and other cultural monuments through Europe, he'd built up the experience to be the one selected eventually for the report into the redevelopment of the South Australian Museum in the mid-70s, after he left the museum as curator. And the Edwards Report is something which deserves a conference on its own, I suppose. It was never fully implemented, largely because of the collapse of the State Bank, but the first parts were, and the main elements still make a lot of sense, I think. So I think his years in the Aboriginal Arts Board, in which he ensured that a group of Aboriginal traditional owners for the key areas of concern, Arnhem Land and Central Australia in particular, were brought to or had the opportunity to visit Sydney in particular, where a lot of the meetings were held, and start to form policy in Aboriginal cultural affairs rather than simply be the recipients of it, was something which was entirely new. The Aboriginal Arts Board was a new organisation, and therefore the brief was open, and Bob essentially occupied that space and formed and shaped a new cultural institution, if you like, in those years, all based on this notion that Aboriginal culture could not be something simply farmed and gathered by Europeans and served up to the broader populace, but had to come about through this dynamic interaction that was continuing with the traditional owners. And this is something that he pushed through with surprising ease. I think if we look back on it now in this period of the 1970s, it was after all the period of we just had the Whitlam years, and the Pigott Report had just come out that John Mulvaney will be speaking about later. So I can see then that he's being equipped really to move offshore, if you like, as Neil was discussing, is something that he was greatly strengthened by these insights that he'd had on fieldwork with Aboriginal people during the earlier period. And in that way, it's possible to follow a thread through his career with this idea that culture could be rendered tangible, even intangible cultural heritage, and that it could be brought to the people. So I've got a role in this conference, which is really simply just to facilitate other people rather than dwelling on the subject too much myself. So I'd like to pass over now to our director, Dr. Suzanne Miller, who has a little moment to make a presentation to Bob that he may not be ready for, but I hope he enjoys. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Philip. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm aware that I stand between all of us in morning tea, so I will be brief. 4 years ago, almost 4 years ago, when I came to this vast continent to the west of French Oceania, I arrived in Australia knowing much about the reputation of Australian museums, but having come as a curator from a European museum, very much knowledgeable about the formidable reputation of one particular Australian. You can't grow up as a curator in Europe without knowing the name of Robert Edwards, which strikes a certain amount of awe and cautiousness amongst his colleagues overseas. And so when I arrived, it was with some trepidation that I was going to meet for the first time in my first board meeting Robert Edwards. You can imagine, really, in some ways, my surprise when the person I was confronted with was not someone with an equally formidable character, but a true gentleman, someone with extraordinary depth and breadth of expertise and knowledge, but someone who was also extraordinarily generous in sharing that expertise and knowledge amongst his colleagues, amongst his peers, and amongst those of us who held him in awe. It is a great pleasure for me to be able, on behalf of the board of the South Australian Museum, on behalf of your colleagues past and present, on behalf of your peers and all of us today, to present, I hope, for you, Bob, the honorary position of Curator Emeritus from the South Australian Museum in recognition of your extraordinary contribution to anthropology, to museums in general, and in creating a quite extraordinary landscape, I think, of international cooperation between museums and galleries. Thank you very much, Bob.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.